Hello, Sophia here. As you may know, I work for a wonderful small business called Firefly Creative Writing, where I coach writers and lead creative writing workshops. I love this work and I love Firefly. It is a business that truly operates by liberatory practices, which is very unique in the business world. Working at Firefly has also helped me learn how to build real, authentic, welcoming community and how to connect with people in ways that feel empowering and real. If you're listening to this episode and wanting to be in spaces where people are encouraged to be honest and alive in the power of connection, you may want to try out one of our workshops. We have a fresh new lineup of workshops happening this fall, starting in September, that are designed to open the door to the pleasure of writing. Whether you're a complete beginner and full of fear, or whether you have a project on the go that you want to move forward. These are cozy workshops, 6 to 8 people max, and most are online. But if you're in Toronto, we have a few in person too. I'm personally running some of these workshops, so come hang out with me or see what my amazing colleagues are up to. Seriously, everyone on this team is so skillful and open-hearted. Any workshop you choose will be amazing. And I'm so happy to be able to gift to you $50 off the workshop with the code FATJOY. You can check out all the workshops at fireflycreativewriting.com, and both the website link and offer code are in the show notes. I hope to see you in a workshop and that you enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome to the Fat Joy podcast, where we talk each week about how to flourish in an anti-fat world. I'm Sophia Apostle, a fat professional coach who loves talking to other fat people about what it's like to live within oppressive systems that marginalize our bodies. And how we still dare to have the audacity and courage to reach towards our collective liberation and embrace our joy. Please know this is an adult content podcast, so there will be swears, we will be talking about harms we've experienced, and we will be rebelling against weight stigma, diet culture, fat phobia, ableism, racism, etc. You can get more Fat Joy goodness, including how you can support the podcast through my newsletter at fatjoy.substack.com. And for episode transcripts, book reviews, and show notes, head to the Fat Joy website at fatjoy.life. I am so glad you're here. Enjoy this episode. Hello, lovelies. Welcome back to the Fat Joy podcast. I am Sophia Apostle. I'm so happy to be here with you today. And my guest for this episode is Karis Stiles. Hi, Karis.
Hello.
It's so good to have you.
I'm super happy to be here.
For those of you who are listening to this audio, you may want to check out the YouTube because I was just admiring Karis's full, like, beautiful artwork, which matches the shade of her hair, which matches her shirt. And we were talking about how I was just told recently by a fashion stylist that I have apparently and obviously given up on all fashion. And so I'm currently aspiring to Karis's level of, like fashion and beauty sense. Like, it really is, it is like aesthetically so beautiful what you're, how you're sitting and where you are. So I just want to shout that out because that matters.
You know, it's taken a while to get here. And it takes a lot of vulnerability to be like, you know, asking other people, like, how does this look, or kind of experimenting. So as I was telling you right before we started recording, I do not always look so coordinated. You know, I'm about to turn 40. And so I'm like, I'm trying to, I don't know, feel like, who am I at this stage of my life? It's feeling pretty good. So yeah, thank you for the very nice feedback.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that bigger question of like, who am I? I feel like that question starts to get asked a lot as I'm about to turn 43. And I feel like I've been asking that in a deeper way since I got into my 40s. I imagine that's going to tie in with what we're going to talk about today, which is like some of the core wounding and living with shame that has impacted who I was and now who I'm trying to be. So I'm excited to dive into all that with you.
Yeah.
Yay. But first, I know who you are, but how about you tell us who you are? Who are you, Karis? What do you do in the world?
Yeah. So I'm a licensed clinical social worker. I'm a therapist operating in California. I do just telehealth, which is also why I've invested in a nice little viewing station for my clients. So I focus primarily on fat liberation work. Sometimes that means I work with clients that have eating disorders or eating disorder histories. Sometimes that means just working with folks in larger bodies around self-acceptance. How do we operate in this world not biting into diet culture? How do we, you know, live in our bodies comfortably without feeling like we have to shrink? And then I work a lot with self-compassion for people that maybe are neurodivergent or struggle with codependency or just in general have felt like I'm an outsider. I don't fit in. I'm queer and I love working with queer people at all of these different intersections also. So yeah, that's kind of what I do. Yeah.
So good. So good. And I love that. I have to say, it's like soothing to my soul to hear someone say, yeah, I'm a therapist and I focus on working with fat liberation, fat positivity, anti-diet culture. Like, oh, it's just so nice that they're out there that I've been so lucky to talk to many people who focus on that. Because when I was going to therapy, that was never something that I even knew was an option. And I don't know that it would have been as I don't know if I would have been able to find someone even who did that, especially when I was going through my eating disorder recovery. Oh, that would have been nice. So thank you for the work that you do. It's important.
Yeah. You know, it was really bred out of an experience I had with my own therapist many years ago. She's a lovely woman, but she is very thin, has always lived in a thin body, has always been very able-bodied also. I live with autoimmune issues too. And so just like living with a body that sometimes does not operate the way I would expect it to, or right, it throws me a lot of curveballs. And I was trying to explain to her one day of like how I don't feel like the world communicates to me that I'm welcome. Like my body isn't included in the design of spaces, right? Like the restaurant chairs actively are telling me my body is, I'm not going to be included here. And she like just was not getting it. She was so like baffled by this. Was so foreign to her. And I just like yelled at her. I started yelling. I was like, you don't get it, what it means to be a fat person in this world, or what it means to be someone who's not always very able-bodied. And she just, you know, was really shocked by it. We repaired and, you know, she was my therapist for many years later. But it was a wake-up call for me of, oh, this is really needed. Therapists need to be able to understand this lived experience. And that is ultimately what led me to move from my kind of agency work into private practice world.
Nice. Yeah. And I was reading in your bio that you actually do help other therapists become more fat positive aware, more. I want to make a joke about, I hope you still yell at them, but I'm sure you don't.
I try not to now.
Yeah. It's probably much better received the way you do it. So, Kiris, this is such a perfect lead into your own journey. You know, what has been your experience living in the world as a fat person, as a queer person, as someone with autoimmune? You've got a few things going on, a few intersectionalities, and I imagine they've all impacted your life in various ways. So tell us a little bit about that.
I don't even know where to begin, but I think very early on in life, recognizing there was something different about me. I think that primarily was my queerness, but also my body was always different, either in the way it functioned with like health issues or just the way it took up space. You know, I grew boobs really early. I sprouted up tall really early. Like I just was always sticking out. And so I think that really shaped this feeling of there's something different about me. I don't quite fit. And so of course it led to a lot of shame experiences for me. I started to learn about more broader like body positivity. Honestly, in the first years of like Pinterest, I feel like that's where like fat fashion started to show
up.
What
is that? Like what year? Do you know around what year?
Thinking I was in grad school, so maybe like 2008, 2009, kind of around then. That's when I remember being like, oh, there are fat people talking about fashion. And so that was my entryway to like, oh, maybe my body doesn't have to change. Maybe I don't have to change what my body looks like. And then when I started having real clear signs of autoimmune issues, my body went through a lot of dramatic changes, primarily like really rapid weight gain. And like, I don't need to say the pounds how many pounds I gained in that year, but it was really dramatic change. And every physician I went to was like, oh, well, the weight, of course, the weight is the cause of all these other symptoms. And I kept trying to describe the weight as a symptom, not a cause. And they weren't really getting it. And a lot of people just assumed I was depressed. And I'm like, no, I am a mental health professional. Like, I know I am. This is not depression. And it took 6 years of getting to get diagnosed. And then once I was diagnosed, like, it's been very radically different. But in that time, I think I also started really developing a more thorough, like, disability justice lens. And that really connected to, like, yeah, this fat liberation lens. And so it took some, like, more, you know, mainstream body positivity and really politicized it and really saw its interconnections with all these other liberation movements, all these other systems of oppression. And yeah, that's kind of where I was like really landed in this firm place of like, my body is like a radical political machine sometimes. And just like existing in this body and having joy in this body is like, yeah, an act of resistance every day.
Yeah. Oh my God, I love that. My body, what was it again? My body is a radical resistance. Oh, you said it so beautifully.
Oh, I think I said my body is like, yeah, a radical political machine, basically.
Radical political machine. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Amazing. When you, was there a point where you were doing kind of more mainstream therapy and then decided to switch your focus?
Well, I had actually been not in a therapy setting. I had actually been working in hospice as a medical social worker. And I thought I would do grief counseling. I had done a lot of that in hospice. So I thought that's what I would kind of eventually do. And then after that incident with my own therapist, I was like, this is clearly, I need to make a change. And it just felt, yeah, I don't know, just like you realize you're calling all of a sudden. You're like, this, I need to leave this work and start an entirely new work. And so, yeah, I do general therapy for folks also. But I would say most of my work is on this topic. Yeah.
I think I know the answer, but I think I'm curious what your perspective is. Do you feel like because you are fat yourself, clients are wanting to choose to work with you for that perspective?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think it helps for them to see my own fatness, especially before the pandemic when I was doing this in person. You know, my belly is like in the room very obviously. And, you know, like my thighs are spreading out when I'm sitting across from you. And right. And just see that I'm wearing clothes that don't hide my body. I think that was really powerful for people.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I love that. My belly is in the room. Yes, it is. Oh, all right. So one of the things we kind of went back and forth about a few topics, and maybe we'll have you back. But what we kind of decided to focus on today was this idea of core wounding and how that connects to living in a larger body. And I'm so excited about this topic because I feel like with the coaching that I do, so I'm not a therapist, obviously, but I'm a trained coach. I've been a coach for 10 years. And so I work primarily with leaders. That's kind of the bulk of my work. So leaders who are in big organizations, everything from like, you know, the Army to Google and everything in between. And I also do creative writing coaching. And it's so fascinating because no matter what I'm coaching people on, at some point, usually pretty early on, as that trust is growing, I'll ask a question like, so if you think back to your childhood, can you see patterns of what you're experiencing right now? And they're always like, oh, yeah. And it's this moment for them of like, oh, there is this pattern that has been established since I was quite young that is now still showing up, perhaps previously unsurfaced or this varietal of it, because as I certainly know, every time I think I've cleaned my wounds out, there's another layer to be explored. And then tracing it into what's going on for them right now, whether that is about being more visible at work. I mean, talk about being told you need to be more visible to elicit the feeling of shame and, oh, definitely childhood stuff, or, you know, writers who are trying to really tap into deep creativity and the vulnerability that requires. So there's all these connections back into kind of where, into our core wounding. And so I'm really excited to talk to you about that today. And I'm wondering, what is the thread that we start pulling? Where do we go into this topic?
Yeah. So I think I use core wounding, shame a little bit interchangeably. They're slightly different, but they're kind of the same thing. And so I think about core wounding as like these really basic human needs of belonging, feeling accepted, feeling like you're lovable. Right? Like, oh, I already feel tender just like saying those things out loud. And I think like that's like a pretty basic human need. And there are all these like early experiences that can disrupt that or can make us feel like, you know, that's unattainable for us, or there's some reason we don't get that, or some way that that gets broken. That feeling of like, I'm safe and I'm like held in some kind of community.
Yeah, yeah. Can you share some examples of how, because again, I'm just thinking about clients I've had this kind of conversation with where they're like, oh, right. It'll usually be, they may not use these words, but it's usually some version of like, oh, my parent was, or my primary caregivers were not really emotionally available. So I learned that I had to be hyper independent, or I learned I had to be hyper vigilant. And there's all these like things that our caregivers have done. Again, no shade to caregivers, not blaming anyone, but because I think we're largely unaware, and hopefully it's getting better and better now as we have more and more knowledge, but, you know, largely unaware of the impact of some of these things. So what are some pretty kind of classic ways that this feeling of not belonging, this feeling of not being lovable, this feeling of not being accepted, having safety and security, feeling threatened, how does that show up for people in your experience?
Oh, so many. I mean, there's 1,000 examples I can give. But yeah, it's often our caretakers, our parents, our teachers, sometimes coaches play a big role, sometimes peers. But it's often, yeah, the adults in our young little life that communicate there's something about us that is not quite right, or something that we need to fix, or some way that affection is conditional. So yeah, sometimes it's just like the old disciplinary ways of like time out, or you don't get to sit at the like you can't be at dinner, you have to go in your room. Like just simple things like that can sometimes communicate I'm on the outside, I don't get to be in the heart of it. I've had examples from clients of like coaches, you know, in early, even elementary school, like sports, telling especially girls, like that your body is either too big or something about your body needs to change. I've had a lot of examples of people with like peers that we learn to be mean to fat kids really early. And so there's a lot of like peer bullying that people have experienced, again, like as early as maybe even first grade. Learning that like there's something different about me. If we add in some intersections of if you're not white, if you have a different like health status or ability status, if you're, of course, class comes into this, like all the isms that we can think of are going to impact this also. So there's, yeah, like all these like larger structural and societal pieces that of course impact like, you know, what our caregivers do, what our peers do. So that adds like additional dimensions that we feel like, yeah, we don't belong. Sometimes it's even like my body or myself is wrong. Like who I am is bad and wrong. Yeah.
It feels so overwhelming sometimes to think about all of those layers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think about this also as leading to a lot of like limiting self-beliefs and like narratives that we tell ourselves about ourselves of like, yeah, if I have to hide this part of myself so that they'll still love me. If they got close enough and they knew what I actually was like on the inside, they wouldn't want to be with me anymore. Or like, that's how it can kind of show up in adulthood a lot.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. So I think of like, so I guess I want to bring in like these limiting belief systems that we have about ourselves that of course are impacted by anti-fatness and racism and ableism and all of that also.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. I totally had forgotten because it's been a long time since I've had this thought, but Karis, I'm going to share like for my version of that I had forgotten, but I remember now is there must be something wrong with this person if they want to date me the way I am. How horrible to think that of myself. But I thought that all through my 20s and a lot of my 30s was like, yeah, there's something wrong with him. This person, this man must be damaged if he wants to date me. Oh,
yeah.
That's horrible.
Yeah. That somehow you're not deserving as much as other people are. That other person might be deserving of it, but something about you, not as deserving.
And I knew, and for me too, at that time, like I knew it was really only related to my fatness. It was like my fat body makes me undeserving. I was like, I'm awesome in every other way, but because I'm also quite cocky. But I knew, I was like, no, it's my fat body. What's wrong with them to want that? Because I so much internalized anti-fatness I carried around for so long.
Totally. Yeah, that's a perfect example of it. And there's probably lots of maybe big moments that led to that limiting belief, but also sometimes really small things. It doesn't have to be big traumas. And maybe you see this with your coaching clients. If it's not always like a really big event in childhood that led to this, it could be tiny comments from people along the way.
I have another example. We're just going to have a therapy session, Karis. I hope you're prepared. Well, just to give an example for people listening, like I remember, I think it was grade 9, being at some kind of like performance where like the dance team and like some other groups were on stage and I was watching and I was with my mom. And I remember my mom pointing out, and you know, it's funny, like I remember exactly who she pointed to. I remember her name. We're still friends on Facebook, which is really funny. She's a couple years old. She was a couple years older than me at the time. I think she was like grade 11 and I was grade 9. And I remember my mom pointing to her and saying that's what your body could look like. Right. And so again, that's like a small moment, but I've never forgotten that moment. And I think it was done from love and all the things that, you know, the people who do love us, you know, say, because they think they're helping us. But all it did was made me feel so ashamed of my body. And then, you know, definitely impacted my relationship with my body, with food, with binging and everything. Yeah. So small things, those really add up. I imagine a lot of people listening have had moments like that.
I had a time once where my mom, again, probably not trying to damage me forever by saying this, but, you know, I was going to visit my older brother who was like, you know, he was in California before I moved out here. And she was like, you're going to embarrass him because of, at that time, like the way I was dressing, which was, you know, very like hippie. And she was like, and just like all thrifted clothes and stuff. And she's like, you're going to embarrass by like your appearance. And of course, I also thought that meant like my body and like its size and its shape. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that was 20, maybe even more than 20 years ago. And I still can remember exactly where I was in the dining room when she told me that. And that has stayed with me for so long. Yeah.
Right. And I imagine, I don't know if it's true with your mom, but I imagine if I asked my mom about it, she would probably say, I would never have said that. I'm like, but, and then I'm like, did I make it up? No, I wouldn't have made that up. Right. So then I start gaslighting myself. I'm like, no, I'm going to actually just trust my memories. They may not be 100% perfect, but like, I wouldn't have made that up. So that's hard too. Cause if you are wanting to have any conversation or, with the, you know, a lot of times in my experience, at least, like my parents don't remember saying these things, which makes sense because why would they? It wasn't impactful for them. I was the one who was impacted, right?
Right. Yeah. And at least in the case of my family, the things my grandmother said to my mom were even worse than what she said to me. So, you know, I've learned to have a lot of compassion for her and seeing like, this is a lot of progression that she has made in the family system, right? If you look at, if you zoom out to the generation, you can see there's been progress, but yeah, it's still super hurtful. I think that speaks to, yeah, we don't always get closure on these kinds of moments. We don't get to repair them. Like, that's the work we have to do as adults. It sucks, but that's kind of, that's the work of, I think of it as like raising ourselves. Like, that's the kind of stuff we have to heal for ourselves.
Yeah, I really like the word reparenting. Although it's funny, I remember the first time I used it with my mom, she's like, I don't like that word. I'm like, you wouldn't. we had some good conversations, me and my mom. But it does feel like a reparenting process, or at least for me, that is definitely what it has felt like, is, you know, how can I don't know, because there is no real, at least in my case, there's no real repair. I can't forget. So like, how do we live with these wounds, Karis? How do we hold compassion for ourselves, compassion for others, and yet also still hold boundaries and also still honor our own agency? Like, it, this is what I'm fascinated by, when all of that comes together and we try to navigate that.
Yeah, totally. It's so complicated. Like, being a human is really hard. It's just so hard. I don't know why we've made it so hard, but we have. But yeah, I think one of the first steps is seeing, how does it show up? Like, how does it not only show up, like, what are the memories that I'm holding on to, but what are some of the behaviors that it really, like, shows up at, right? So like, those limiting beliefs, those core wounds, that like deep shame that I try to hide from everybody, how does it show up in my daily life? So we see it, I mean, your example of like, well, I don't really believe this guy actually wants to be with me. And so maybe I date real jackasses then, because I don't believe like a good quality person is going to want to be with me. Or maybe I really do a lot of people pleasing, codependency, kind of like compensating, right? Like, I have that history too.
People pleaser are so bad, so bad. Oh my God. working actively on it.
Yeah, it's a hard one to unlearn. Yeah. Like, we see it a lot in perfectionism. Perfectionism and shame, I could talk about forever, those connections between those two. And I mean, we really see like how we've internalized it. And before we started recording, kind of talking about externalizing versus internalizing. And these moments where, like, especially with someone like a parent or someone that we think loves us or should love us pretty unconditionally, when they give us these kind of messages, like, of course we internalize them, especially as kids. Like, we internalize a lot as kids. So we really internalize blame. And then really placing like our sense of self or our sense of self-worth on external feedback. And that's one I see like all the time. I think that's a super normal one.
Can you give me an example of that? Like, what does that, how does that show up?
Yeah. So if you get, you know, maybe not so great feedback at work, you're like devastated. Like, who am I anymore? What am I doing here? Like, right, you're spiraling, you can't sleep, like it kind of consumes you. Or we see it a lot in dating of, okay, I have to really prepare for this date. I have to, I'm analyzing everything he said, everything she said. What am I going to do next? What am I going to wear? Like, it's just like the mental and emotional effort into preventing like any potential bad feedback, examining any feedback you have, like you do get of like, what does that really mean? Like, right? Like, just like the ruminating, I think, is a good example of it.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah, the ruminating. And I'm also, again, hearing this like hypervigilant state and also like a lot of suspicion. Like, no, maybe it's, I don't know, this might be very therapy of me, but like, if I can't trust myself, how can I trust anyone? It's like that whole relationship with self-trust not being there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see that. And then I also see, I can't trust myself. I can only trust other people.
Oh, interesting, right? Oh,
which, you know, I grew up in a very like religious household. And so that was very directly the message of, like, you know, especially growing up Southern Baptist and growing up queer and being like, yeah, I can't trust my desire. I can't trust my body. And so learning to, yeah, trust others and really actively untrust yourself.
Yeah. Well, and that makes me think about how diet culture actually trains us to also do that, to ignore an intentional weight loss, like ignore your hunger cues or just drink water and eat celery instead of actually eating, right? Like we're really taught to disassociate from our body's own wisdom and authority.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Yeah. I remember this, maybe it was actually even on Pinterest back in the day, but like a little like diagram of like, oh, if you're craving this, actually eat this. Oh, if you want chocolate, oh, you want magnesium. So you want almonds. And if you are craving this, oh yeah, drink water instead. And you're like, well, let me just have the chocolate. Why? What's wrong with the chocolate? But like, exactly. Like I can't trust my cravings. It's actually almonds that I want, not the chocolate. And you're like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah. So how do we go from believing that we want the almonds to actually honoring what we do want and trusting our own desires?
It is sometimes a lengthy process. So I give that caveat of like, this is not an easy thing to fix because we're talking about potentially decades of messaging that we're having to unlearn. And of course, as a therapist, I'm like, yeah, this is long, sometimes even lifelong work. But I think about, well, first of all, like shame really thrives in silence. So letting this out, either in therapy, coaches, with trusted friends, even by yourself in maybe a journaling practice, like starting to let this out instead of holding it in is going to be really helpful. Developing stronger sense of self-worth, like I love coming up with like lists of things people like about themselves, especially that have nothing to do with what they do for others. So not just how you're serving people and like, oh, what a good person I am, but like things about yourself, like your taste in music or your sense of humor or things like that to build a sense of self that actually has nothing to do with the body. Knowing that the body is going to change throughout our lifetime. Right? That's one of the things that I'm just going to make a little plug for gerontology for a second and saying working with older adults and working at the end of life and the beginning of my career really informs of like, yeah, I don't want to like over connect or over identify with the body because it's going to be changing. I'm going to go through menopause and my body's going to change through that. I'm going to be hopefully 70 and my ability levels or my strength will be different or I think that can be a flaw in some of the, especially more body positive, spaces where it's like, oh, my body can do this and I can feel really good about that. That's great for now, but that might shift. And also as somebody where what my body can do every day changes, like I don't want my self-worth or my connection to my body be built on something that can change. Right. So that's my little thing about aging.
Yeah. Well, it's so smart because it's reminding me of like what, like would we call this body neutrality or is that something different?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah. I think basically we're talking about body neutrality. And yeah, when we politicize like how my body should be treated by external systems and structures, that's where it feels a little more like fat liberation work. But yeah, like coming up with a more for your own self, like a body neutral stance, I think can be helpful. And it can be positive, but have it like with that caveat of like, and I know it's going to be okay if my size, my shape, my ability, my health status change.
Yeah, that's the piece. Not being devastated if anything does change. Yeah, because that's the, I mean, you know, I'll just speak to, you know, what I see, especially on Facebook groups that I'm a part of. Like I'm part of a few mom groups and oh my goodness. I've pretty much stopped going because so many times, multiple times a day, it's, I've gained a bit of weight. I can't handle it. I'm losing my mind. And I don't know if these people are straight size or fat or not. I mean, it doesn't matter, but it's like deep distress
about any change in their body size. There's, as far as well, they're still able-bodied. There's like, there wasn't an injury. There wasn't anything happening. It was more just my body's changed after having a kid, or, and I can't seem to like, and the, it is like distress that, that we're in. And I mean, I get that. I have felt that too. Every time I've, you know, gained and lost weight through the years, through intentional weight loss. And then like those were deeply emotionally challenging times trying to exert control over my body.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. One of the things that I like to do with folks of like how to kind of externalize this kind of voice, this voice that says, yeah, like my body shouldn't change, or I should be able to fit into my prom dress or whatever. It's, yeah, like learning to externalize it. So maybe bringing some like playfulness to that externalizing. And I often do with clients, like coming up with like a creature or like a persona of, I had one client call it like this little gnat that was just like constantly, you know, circling around them, just like giving little like body criticisms and just general criticisms to them all day long. I had someone describe it as like, yeah, like a shame, like creature. And that it would sometimes be really big and sometimes it would be a little smaller, but it just had this like, yeah, kind of like amoeba like form where it would fit into whatever the scenario was. And then you're just like kind of fleshing out, like creating like a persona for it. So you can start kind of externalizing that voice and be like, oh, here's my little shame creature. Here it is. This is, oh, here it is. This is what it's saying again. So silly, you know, and like we can play with it. And I don't know, it makes it a little easier to work with, to take it out of like your inner self.
Yeah, bring some distance into it. I love that. Yeah. Is that come from, what's it called, internal family systems work, where we pull out like parts of ourselves so that we can, you know, kind of have some space to interact with it, where it's not all like all the voices at once from the inside.
Yeah, so that's an awesome technique for it. Yeah, you get a lot of nuance where you get to know a lot of different parts and kind of what their different roles are. I think I came up with this technique from my expressive art background, which was a little more like, yeah, let's make like a sand tray and, you know, use different little figurines and, or let's like draw this out. Let's even, you know, move our bodies in this way. So I think that's kind of where that came from for me. But IFS is a totally useful technique for this also.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, with when we used to do inner critic work with the creative writing student, when we would do more in person, we would actually give everyone around the table like a jar of Play-Doh and be like, okay, like make your inner critic. You know?
Yeah.
We've shifted that, and now I have them draw. Like we'll like draw and have them describe it, like what do they look like? What do they sound like? What's their motto? What makes them happy? Like you almost build a character around them. Yeah. And then what I have them do is I'll then go to like the opposite part of themselves. So like their inner writer voice or their inner brave voice or their most vulnerable self, and create that character. And then we put them in dialogue with each other.
Yeah.
And it's so wild.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. I like to kind of come up with like kind of like the self-compassion voice. I often call it like the fairy godmother, like that just like swoops into the room and wants to like embrace you and just cuddle you and take care of you and like something with that kind of vibe to it.
Oh, I love it. Yeah. There's so many ways we can play with this. So anyone listening who's interested in this, like think of, I mean, maybe you want to say, I'll share something and then you correct me, you make it better. I'm curious. But I often think like, if there's a part that we're wanting to embody more, if there's a part of ourselves that we're wanting to turn the volume up a little more to help quiet some of the other nastier voices, like I love to think of it too, is like, what animal energy would that be? Would that be, do I need lion today? Or do I need like cheeky raven? Or do I need spider? You know? So I think like this is where I think metaphor works so well for people to help conceptualize in an instant really complex ideas. Like if I want
spider, let's say, I might want spider because I want it to just wrap something up and not let it move anymore, right? But I could just say spider. And then there's like my brain, I mean, our brain loves metaphor, right? So I think this, what we're talking about too, is rooted in that brain's ability to take metaphor and in one word, know exactly the feeling to elicit and to evoke.
Yeah, I love that. And like, as we're saying, like add some play, add some like silliness to it of, you know, how can we take ourselves and the world a little less seriously? There's a lot of heartbreaking, upsetting things happening all the time. We're like pretty stressed and under a lot of pressure all the time. How do we like lighten it? And how do we, yeah, especially in this process of like reparenting ourselves, how do we lighten the tone of it? And so this metaphor, like animals, I love it. That's amazing and perfect. And like add some play to it.
Yeah. I had a therapist once who would have me make a statue with my body of whatever it is we were talking about. And I was like, oh, this is really weird, but also totally works, because if I'm in this pose or position, whatever it was, my body, like I could feel it in a very embodied way. And of course, my work has been to come back to being embodied from being very disembodied for so long, and to almost like use that feeling of being the statue of it as a benchmark to know, like 3 days from, you know, that point, oh, I got that feeling again. Right. Because that's what I felt when I was in statue mode.
Yeah. I know sometimes we have clients do really weird and uncomfortable things, but it's for a reason. And that's a great reason. And like, and it brings it to this point of like, our bodies can be really good tools for this work, right? Like, it's like, how do we utilize our body to actually help us like do this healing work? So yeah, how do we be the statue and kind of feel the embodiedness of it? How do we learn to like feel our emotions in our bodies as they're happening? How do we use our bodies to give us comfort, to give us care, to like help us express self-compassion? Yeah, our body is a tool. And as much as we're trying to reconnect with it, it's also something that's here to assist us.
Yeah, yeah. I want to layer in fatness in a more deliberate way. So, because we've been talking, and I think everything we've been talking about can apply to everybody, as, and I hope people are very interested in exploring it further. But now if we layer in fatness, what is unique about bringing that layer in? Anyone who's fat, who's listening, what do we need to know, Karis? What would you have us know?
So fatness is definitely one of the things that is used against fat people throughout their lives, right? To tell them that, yeah, they don't belong, sometimes very structurally, environmentally, right? Like my example of, yeah, restaurant chairs or plane seats is the most classic example, right? But all these different ways that we're taught our bodies are not welcome, or even that we are instructed, even from very, very early ages, that our bodies maybe even are dangerous. Right? That our fatness is going to kill us and that we're going to die early. Fatness is used as a reason why we're not lovable, we're not going to be able to date. There's a lot of things that we're taught as fat people that our lives are not going to be as good, and that we have to change who we are. And that we're also taught our fatness is our fault and that there's a morality to that failing. So there's like a lot of shame in just that right there. And then, yeah, learning how to, like, in that process, we disconnect from our bodies. And so, yeah, we disconnect from sometimes boundaries and abilities to have boundaries, notice them, feelings, and so forth. Like, yeah, there's a thousand pieces of how fatness plays into this. Just like every other ism, but specifically for fat people. Yeah.
Yeah. So once we recognize that that is what's going on, once it's kind of surfaced, we're doing some inner work, we're trying to kind of wade through this, what are some ways, and I don't know if this is where self-compassion comes in, but like, what are some ways that we can support ourselves in the, I mean, my words for it would be like the deeply healing journey that I had to go through of like reclamation of self, independent of every single thing I had been told and taught.
Yeah, totally. Mm-hmm. Fat community is amazing for this, right? And the fat community that you're building through your podcast and through like your Substack and everything is definitely part of that. So sometimes for those of us that are fat, it can only be virtual. Some of us get to have it in person, but fat community is super healing for this. We get to feel belonging. We get to feel like there's like a shorthand of understanding experiences. So many shared experiences as fat people, no matter, yeah, any other parts of our identity, just being fat in this world, we share so much. That is super healing. And then of course, yeah, self-compassion is a big part of it. To me, self-compassion really includes that process of externalizing the shaming voices and learning, reparenting ourselves, learning how to recognize and validate our own feelings, and then build some self-trust of, I trust my instincts. When someone is giving me some red flags, I can trust that. I can trust that, you know, there are good things about myself. And if someone is being really critical, that might be saying more about themselves than me. Not that I'm not going to be open to feedback, but like I'm not taking in every ounce of feedback that I get as total truth. I'm going to be more discerning about it. Right? We build a lot of like trust that like my body can take care of me, that I know how to comfort and take care of myself, that I have resources to cope with. Like if there is some catastrophe that happens, if my anxiety is right and right, everything blows up, I can trust that, well, I can make it through this. I can figure out how to repair. I can figure out how to take care of myself through it. I can trust I can actually help myself be okay at the end of it.
Yeah. I want to ask you a question that I want the answer to be yes to, but I don't know if it is. So I'm just telling you, I'm going in biased. Do you feel that fat people who have gone through this journey are way more resilient than like the average person?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't have that personality that's maybe like a little more fiery, even if they're a little bit more of like a quiet or introverted kind of person, this gives a lot more strength. I have a client that is a dear client of mine, and I've been working with them for a couple years now, and they're fat, they're neurodivergent, they've got some chronic health issues, so they have all these, they're also queer, like they have all these like intersections where life throughout their lifetime has told them, yeah, they're not good enough, or they don't fit, there's something different about them. And they have learned very quietly to like externalize that, to like just have that like quiet, like kind of inner pillar of strength where they're not swayed, they're not like shaken up by the feedback. They're just like, oh yeah, that's not mine. And right. And so some people have more of that fire, like I'm a little more of a fighter kind of person. So yeah, I'm going to yell at somebody. Like I'm going to be a little bit louder about that. But you don't have your fat liberation, your self-acceptance doesn't have to look that way. It can also be just like really calm, really like centered in yourself.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, you gave the answer I was wanting. Because I feel like, I don't know, whenever, you know, life is always throwing curveballs and there's always unexpected stuff that happens. And I feel like my partner who has anxiety, he's like, how are you not freaking out? I'm like, I feel like I just know that it's going to, not that it's going to be okay, but like, I know that I'll be fine because I have gone through so much. I've done so much work to come to my center, to know what that means. I have all these like beautiful scaffolding base coping skills. I have like my family of choice. Like I just have done enough where it's like, yeah, like I know I will be able to weather this storm because I've weathered so many others. So I was just, when you said what you said right before I asked the question, I was like, I think we're way more resilient because living in a fat body, almost if we allow it or if we choose it to, we kind of have to build that resilience to just make it through.
Totally. Yeah. I think that can be said for a lot of people that are in these like groups where there's a lot of bias towards them, right? We all kind of have to, because otherwise it would be so crushing. And I think many of us let it crush us for a long time. And fatness is, right? Fatness is one of the biases that we're taught we can control and that we should be able to, I mean, we not only can control it, but we should control it. So I think it's one that we internalize really, really easily.
Yeah. Yeah. Agree. Yeah. So good. So interesting. I've loved this conversation about all of these aspects of core wounding and reparenting and how we connect to feelings of belonging and acceptance. So I want to turn to Joy, Karis. What are, because you're a therapist and because you support people in this way, I'm actually going to ask you a different question than I ask other guests. As a therapist, as someone who supports others, I may overgeneralize and say connect to their own joy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, their joy, their purpose, their reason for, you know, moving through this world. What do you think are the components of joy? Like, do you feel like we create it? Do you feel like it just shows up? Like, what do you think are the mechanics of joy?
Oh, what a difficult question.
I know. You're welcome. You're welcome.
Really feels very individual. I think there are some personalities that have a little bit more of that, like, buoyancy to their vibe, right? They're a little sillier by nature, a little more like out of the box kind of thinkers, I think, and that can maybe naturally find that joy, that playfulness a little bit more easily. I think a lot of us that have been taught of like achievement is what we need to really focus on, or doing, or people that maybe have, yeah, had to like struggle in different, maybe really large ways in life. And I think I'm saying this again as I'm approaching 40 and just like feeling like the weight of middle age, like the heaviness of this time of life where we're so bogged down in daily responsibilities. I do think we have to start creating joy. And I do think for many of us, it takes sometimes effort. It takes vulnerability. It takes a willingness to be like embarrassing and embarrass yourself. And it takes a lot of vulnerability to create joy, I think.
Yeah, I love that answer. Yeah, I'm with you. Also, can we just give a shout out to all the middle-aged people listening? It is really hard. Being middle-aged is hard. I'm really feeling it. And I'm still surprised. I shouldn't be. It's been a few years I've been feeling it. But like, oh, I'm like, surely it's going to get easier, but I don't know if it will until what, 60? I don't know.
I will say from my gerontology days, older people, especially older women, report really high levels of like satisfaction. They usually feel better about their bodies. They report like better friendships. They honestly even report like better sex. So I do think it gets better. I think we're in a not so great time now, but I do think it gets better.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Thank goodness. Yay. Thank you for that. So what brings you joy, Karis? How do you connect to joy? How do you invite it in and create the conditions for it?
Yeah. So animals are a great way. I have a very silly golden retriever and she is like the goofiest goo. So that is a lot of joy. I love making art and sometimes it's very silly, very ridiculous little collages. Sometimes I just make little wobbly ceramic pots and just like creativity is a fun way for me to experience joy. And then I don't have kids myself, but the kids in my life can be a great source of, yeah, like they don't take themselves seriously. Like they don't realize they're embarrassing themselves, but dancing at like the taco place, right? They don't know what they're doing. So that is also, yeah, a source of joy for me.
Oh, I love it. Amazing. Oh, Karis, you're delightful and brilliant. I'm so glad we got to talk to you. Thank you for taking us through all of that. And also for like the very real like techniques that you gave us, things that we can try. This was really a beautiful conversation.
Oh, I'm so glad. This is stuff that just gives me life to be able to talk about. So thank you for having me.
Before we go, I'd like to read a poem because poetry can reach our hearts in a different way. Poems can have us feel in a different way. And that's what this podcast is all about. Expanding our hearts, deepening our empathy, and inviting in joy. So each week, you get a new poem.
This conversation with Karis reminds me of how much makes us who we are, our lived experience, our wounds, our desires, our hopes, and how so much of it can feel quite happenstantial. I don't know if that's a word, but I'm going to use it, happenstantial. This poem is called Starfish by Eleanor Lerman, and it has that same feel to me, this joy of the unexpected and unanticipated that we can roll with and open up to. So here it is, Starfish. This is what life does. It lets you walk up to the store to buy breakfast and the paper on a stiff knee. It lets you choose the way you have your eggs, your coffee. Then it sits a fisherman down beside you at the counter who say, last night the channel was full of starfish. And you wonder, is this a message finally or just another day? Life lets you take the dog for a walk down to the pond where whole generations of biological processes are boiling beneath the mud. Reeds speak to you of the natural world. They whisper, they sing, and herons pass by. Are you old enough to appreciate the moment? Too old? There is movement beneath the water, but it may be nothing. There may be nothing going on. And then life suggests that you remember the years you ran around, the years you developed a shocking lifestyle, advocated careless abandon, owned a chilly heart. Upon reflection, you are genuinely surprised to find how quiet you have become. And then life lets you go home to think about all this, which you do for quite a long time. Later, you wake up beside your old love, the one who never had any conditions, the one who waited you out. This is life's way of letting you know that you are lucky. It won't give you smart or brave, so you'll have to settle for lucky. Because you were born at a good time, because you were able to listen when people spoke to you, because you stopped when you should have and started again. So life lets you have a sandwich and a pie for your late night dessert, pie for the dog as well. And then life sends you back to bed to dreamland while outside the starfish drift through the channel with smiles on their starry faces as they head out to deep water, to the far and boundless sea.
Thank you for joining me today. My hope is that you're feeling a little less alone and a little more seen. So until the next episode, you can find me on Instagram at fatjoy.life, on YouTube at youtube.com/@fatjoy, and on Substack at fatjoy.substack.com. And please do check out the episode notes for how you can connect with my amazing guest and for the links to the poem. All right, lovely, I am sending you off with my best wishes for an abundantly fat joy day, and we'll talk again soon.